Welcome to the podcast that's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee, and joining me today is Coach Chad Timmerman, like normal. Hey, Chad.
Hey, Jonathan.
And we also have Nate Pearson, CEO of Trainer Road, with us as well.
Hello.
How you doing, Nate?
Good.
All right. So let's kick this off, and let's start off with a bunch of questions. We have all of your questions today. Forgive me, before we get into those, I just want to remind you of just a few different things. This is the podcast where you can submit your questions, your training questions, and we'll answer them for you. So you can submit those at a number of different places. You'll see on our Facebook page, we have a link for that, or you can submit them to just support@trainerroad.com, and we'll get you to the right place where you can enter those questions. You can get this podcast on iTunes. You can look us up there. Just look for Trainer Road or cycling, anything like that. And you can also find us on SoundCloud as well. If you like the podcast and it's of any help for you or you're enjoying it, let us know. Give us a review on iTunes. We'd appreciate that. And if you feel like leaving us 5 stars, we will give you 5 virtual high fives. So we will appreciate that. So. Yes, exactly. Each of us. So, but let's kick off with a few questions we didn't get to last week. We had a lot of questions, and we're getting to those. By the way, if you did submit a question, we'll be getting to you. We'll be getting back to you, whether it's through this podcast or just through a separate answer through email. We will get you the answers you need. We just got a lot of them last week. But we're going to start out with one question from Paul. He says, "I want to climb hills faster, and currently I'm in my easiest gear and my cadence is low." And this is a local rider, so he gives a workout that many of you are actually familiar with called Geiger, and he wants to climb the actual Geiger climb here in Reno area. He wants to climb it faster. So his question, what kind of intervals should I practice to get faster? Should I train at the lower cadence and or focus on anything special?
Yeah, so last week we addressed this question. It was somebody else's question, but it related to Paul's, and we kind of lumped the two together. And I said, basically, you need to increase your strength. That's one possible route to climbing a bit faster. But I didn't give anything more specific than that, so I kind of wanted to do that. And obviously, the lighter you can make yourself and the more powerful you can make yourself, the faster you're going to go up hills. But I'm going to assume that both those things are already being considered, as is compact gearing. So if you're using compact gearing and you're still geared out on, and I know Geiger grade, it's not a particularly steep grade. So basically lift your FTP. And in your case, that probably more the, in terms of strength endurance, you're probably lacking more on the strength side of things. Could be, and it probably is a combination of the both, but strength needs to be addressed. Whether you address that strength in the gym or on the bike is entirely up to you. But I'm going to give you some on the bike recommendations. And basically it's the anaerobic sort of work. You want to be able to generate more muscle force. You want to be able to drive the pedals harder. And if you don't address that specifically, it's never going to improve. It doesn't happen magically. So the anaerobic workouts are the best way to go, especially the ones, and most of them are structured this way, where you work really hard for brief periods, 15, 30, maybe 45 seconds, and then you rest for relatively long periods before you do it again, so that you're getting big recruitment, big muscle activity each time. So shift at least some of your workouts more towards strength training than the endurance end.
So, Chad, I am going to publicly disagree with you about your answer.
Do
so
it.
this is why there's a couple things with this question. So, ones that people know, Geiger grade averages about 5.1%, and the climb, if you're Greg LeMond grew up around Reno, and he used to do it in about 29 minutes, but you know a fair time is 40 minutes, but a lot of people do it in an hour. The biggest thing that I read in this, it says I'm in my easiest gear and my cadence is low. So I think that the best solution for Paul is to get a compact and switch out your rear cassette to something easier. There's like this thing in cycling that if you have, like, you have to ride a standard, like I'm stronger because I have a standard crank, but it's so not true. If you, the point that got it home to me is a couple years ago in the Giro. A guy who won, I forget who it was, but he had a compact and a 28 in the back, and he rode that, and he's a pro, and none of us are stronger than him, and he won the Giro on that. So how can you say that I'm too strong for a compact, especially if you're having problems up the hill? On the other side of that, if you have an 11, so a compact with 11 is faster than a standard than a 12. in your highest gear. So you can think about that. And then also on the other side, if you have an 11 in a standard, when you're really going super fast and you have a high cadence, it's probably better to, you're not probably doing that in a sprint. It's probably on some kind of downhill. So at those speeds, you might want to think about tucking and kind of saving some of your energy rather than trying to, you know, spin at 120 and really fight the wind. That being said, let me go back to the question about anaerobic and strength. Geiger is definitely an endurance climb, and it's more about FTP and not about, you shouldn't ever go anaerobic on Geiger. It's really the correct gearing to ride at. So if, let's say he goes up at 150 watts or at 250, he should really be doing a steady climb on Geiger and having the right gearing and having a higher power to weight ratio.
I actually agree completely, and we are on the same page. You're not disagreeing at all, because I assumed that he'd already explored the compact gearing. I said that as a caveat to kick this off. So in the event that you simply don't have the strength, regardless of the gearing, you're already compact, you're already turning like a 32 tooth cog, and you're maxed out or you're spun out, then you have to increase your strength. But
it's
everything
like mountain
that
Nate
biking said
would
is
be
absolutely. Exactly, mountain bike gearing. But that everything Nate said is absolutely applicable. And on the climbs that aren't dreadfully steep, muscle endurance is absolutely it. So the anaerobic efforts are not to be applied on the climb. They're to condition you such that you can recruit more muscle so that you can use more active muscle when you are climbing at 80, 90, 95% of threshold.
And something that actually specifically applies to this climb, which I know for those of you that don't know about this area, hopefully you're not saying, you know, what gives, I don't know what this climb is. This is a very typical climb. Nate broke down the data for you, but it's a 5% climb. It's pretty consistent, but it has small fluctuations throughout it, just like any other climb. And it takes a fast cyclist anywhere between 30 and 40 minutes. But I want to hit home a point that really helps on Geiger grade and plenty of other climbs for me in this case, especially if I'm finding that I'm running out of gears, whatever my gearing setup may be. And growing up as a motocross racer, the way to get faster in a lot of situations, because you think it's easy, you just twist the wrist, but it's hunting for speed. And we used to call it digging for speed. And I always do that when I'm on the road bike, or on the mountain bike, whatever it is. I look for when it pitches down 1 degree, I am going to work as hard as I can to get my cadence up. I'm not going to exhaust myself, but I'm going to find every little opportunity to increase my cadence and maybe actually grab another gear. So then I have that gear in reserve. It's kind of a mental thing that really helps, but always looking for spots that you can speed up your legs really helps.
And that brings me to, that's a perfect segue into the second part of Paul's question. I don't want to beat this short question to death, but he talks about training at a lower cadence or focusing on anything special. And the problem with lower cadence training is it's not speed specific or it's not cadence specific. So if you can churn out the watts at 60 RPM, that's all good and fine. But when are you ever going to use that on the road? It's not, in my opinion, it is not a good way to cultivate on the bike strength. Rather, shoot for your watts and figure an applicable cadence. If you're going to climb Geiger between 80 and 90 RPM, then try to generate greater power, you know, more force at 80 to 90 RPM. Be as specific as you can, even in the earlier phases of training.
Kevin, in doing the deep breathing during VO2 max intervals, when you're forcefully exhaling, I often end up with numbness in my teeth and gums by the end of the workout. We covered this question last week, but we didn't do the best job of answering this one. And he asks, is this totally weird, talking about the numb teeth and gums? Any suggestions on how to avoid it?
And we actually did do a good job of answering the question, and we had nothing to base this on. So I did a little research for you, Kevin, went the extra mile, and tried to figure out, you know, what could possibly be causing that. And quite simply, I bared my teeth. I understand when people are working this hard, they probably get that, you know, that facial contortion, that grimace, and they're gutting it out, really trying to last the interval. And, you know, I opened my mouth in such a way that my teeth and gums were exposed, and I'm huffing and puffing, and sure enough, teeth and gums went numb. So my advice to you is try not to grimace so sharply, aggressively.
And that's probably good advice for, you talk about in your workout text, Chad, that if you're kind of putting all this energy into your face and your shoulders, that's wasted energy, right?
It is, absolutely. And that, it doesn't like carry to your face, it stems from your face. I mean, it starts somewhere. And oftentimes, if you've got that sort of facial expression, that's going to go through your neck, it's going to raise your shoulders, it's going to bunch you up, you're going to be over gripping the bars, and you're wasting a lot of energy that could otherwise be devoted to turning the pedals.
It's also a good tactic for road racing because if guys see you like that, they're going to attack you. And
highly tactical.
Yeah. Sometimes you want to look like that and sometimes you don't. So,
yeah. If it's genuine, you got to hide it. You can't let people know you're hurting.
Absolutely. You look at a lot of guys, like look at Quintana. He's such a good example of that. You never, like, it could be Quintana's birthday or it could be his funeral and you wouldn't know any different. So, it's a really, really, and with road racing especially, that is something that you really should be working on. Yeah, extremely important. So, Stephen, you have a question that you've just submitted that I feel like it kind of ties into Paul's question. So we're going to touch on this one really quick. You're saying that you're 5'7", you're 132 pounds, you can fly up hills, but when riding on flats, it can be difficult to keep up. So we've got a guy kind of in the opposite position. He's a good guy at climber, but it's or a good climber, but it's tough to keep up on the flats. What would be the best workout or plan to improve? You mentioned our hill climb specialty plan to improve muscular endurance or just muscular endurance workouts in general. It seems like muscular endurance is a good place to start, Chad, but what do you think here?
Stephen, that's your theme. So muscular endurance is absolutely where you need to start. And I've actually kind of shied away from the term muscular endurance because it's not as descriptive as its alternate term, which is strength endurance. You know, you need to be strong and you need to be able to endure that strength. Keep it going. In your case, you have an excellent strength to weight ratio, but maybe not excellent raw strength. So when it comes to the flat where your lightweight doesn't serve you, that muscular strength is what's going to make up the difference. So, you know, the sort of efforts that or the sort of workouts and training plans that allow you to sustain high percentages of your threshold without exceeding it, you know, 90, 95, 98, 99% of it for long periods of time. Should be your focus.
So yeah, I was going to ask that, Chad. So when you say that, it's really just right below FTP. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, and there's a lot of science, a lot of research and findings that support working slightly below threshold is almost equally as productive as working at threshold, and it exacts a far kinder physiological toll.
And Stephen, the other comment I have on this is you're the opposite of me. So I'm 6'6", about a foot taller than you. And right now I'm about 205, but I'll race about 180. I'm awesome on the flats, hard on the hills. The one thing that you could do, and especially if you're racing against me, is improve your aerodynamics on the flats because that's the number one force that you're trying to overcome. So if you can like get, you know, tuck low, you can, even if you're racing too, and you're getting dropped, maybe a more aerodynamic bike could help or just start with a helmet or something, but try to reduce the pressure or the how much wind resistance you're going against. And also as a really tall person sitting behind you, man, the guys that are that can really get small, it hurts me so much more. It feels like I'm in the wind the whole time. And if you're racing against me, that's an excellent tactic to tire me out so that when we get to the climb, you'll just blow me. I mean, you'd probably blow me away anyways, but I'm already so tired from the flats from never getting rest to be behind somebody.
Yeah, and strategically, just tuck in. Spend as little time as you can in the wind. I mean, you know your raw strength, your raw power isn't gonna put you in front. And if it does, you're gonna get up there, you're gonna take a short turn, you're gonna tuck back in and hope that people forget about you. So use these bigger riders to help you get to the points on the race course where you excel.
Also, Stephen, us climbers, I'm similar in many respects to you. Us climbers many times develop a somewhat undisciplined position on the bike just because of the fact that we're going uphill. As we're going uphill, we're generally sitting more upright. We can get away to a certain extent with a little more of a, I guess I should say, an inefficient pedaling technique. That's not entirely true, but generally that's very common just because of the fact that high force is required. Many times you end up building a pedaling style that's a lot of mashing. If you can refine your position on the bike, this ties in exactly to what Nate was saying, and it can make a huge difference. This year, I really focused on that, and I'm primarily a mountain biker, but I focused on being efficient in the flats, increasing my strength endurance, and it was a pretty good road race season for me. So especially in the flats, I did extremely well there in pan flat criteriums and everything else. So yeah, great points.
Yeah, and too, if you look at the Tour de France and look at the break, all the guys, I'm amazed by their positions because they all look like they're on a TT bike with how flat their back is compared to the road. And I'm never like that. And, you know, they have to be so efficient when they're in that break so the peloton doesn't catch them.
Yeah. Yeah. Great points. Laris, if I do most of my training and racing on a road bike with regular chain rings, would I benefit from oval chain rings on my TT bike, or should I stick with round chain rings? Do I need to spend as much time as possible on the oval chain rings to get the most out of them? We actually, our filmmaker is constantly bouncing back and forth between oval chain rings and standard chain rings. What do you guys think? Chad, go ahead and take this one first.
So Laris, this is a timely question because Dave Christensen, our videographer, we were just describing this because I'm a big fan of rotor rings, which are subtly ovalized, and he's a big fan, or he at least has used. What are Dave's rings, Jonathan?
He's using the they're pretty exaggerated. Osymmetric is the
name. The osymmetrics, which are they're dang near square. So it's excessive, and Dave has a hard time when he switches back and forth. And I think it's because it's such a vast departure. There's such a big disparity between those two. However, it's subtler with the particular rings I use. And it's easy for me. 5 minutes into a ride, it doesn't matter which I'm using. I've adapted to it and I'm okay with it. In terms of the benefit, there's nothing terribly conclusive. It's pretty subjective. Some people love them. Some people claim that their riding is faster because of them. It's up to you to determine that. I will say I have less knee issues when I use the rotor rings, the slightly ovalized ones.
Yeah, if there's one thing I could add to this, the only thing that I do know for certain about running ovalized rings is you will get poor front derailleur shifting. That's about as conclusive as I can get on that. Nate, have you had any experience with this, or do you have any opinions on that?
No, I haven't. And some people do it on their TT bike, and it's supposed to help with, because your hip angle is so much more acute more on severe. Your TT bike. Yeah. But I don't really know. Froome uses them, so I better use them, right? I don't know. I just don't know.
Mitchell, this is a training plan question. I'm currently planning my base training for 2016, and my first high priority event is in late June. So this is actually pretty similar to a lot of you guys in that sense, in that a lot of us are preparing for late or for races that start or go off sometime around June, July. That's a common thing for most of us in the Northern Hemisphere. My first high priority event is in late June. I'm trying to pick the best base recipe for me. So trying to pick the best base training. You're carrying a high level of fitness into this fall and you want to get the most out of the next season and considering two alternatives. So first of all, Chad, that's a really common question. And I think that we should address that. If you're coming in with fitness, do you need to do base training again? That's a really common one.
It is. And people think that they have to ride the wave that they're on when in fact it isn't. It is a wave. It's going to dip. So let it dip and just start from scratch again. And you're not exactly starting from scratch. Ideally, optimally, every year you bring a slightly more fitness to the table. So you're starting at a higher plane. So where it may seem like taking a break or not even taking a break, but reverting back to base training that you're going to sacrifice some of your high-end fitness, you are. Temporarily, it's going to come back though, and the base that you're building higher and higher, or wider and wider, as it were, each year will reward you with higher levels of high end fitness. But it has to be cyclical. The body won't allow you to simply improve without any limitations. At some point, there has to be a downturn. So why not time that downturn to best suit your schedule and your most important event or events?
So there's two approaches to handling your base training, I guess, to generalize things, and perhaps this is a gross generalization, but really there's the traditional low and slow approach, right? The long, slow and just big distance type of deal, right, Chad? And yes. Then there's this, and then what we call sweet spot training. So it's sweet spot base. We have a training plan built around that, and it's tends to be the one that's more commonly used by a lot of people, but Chad, the low and slow approach, I think that's pretty self-explanatory. A lot of people know a lot about it, but a big challenge that people face and Mitchell's facing here is he says that fitting in big, long weekday rides is not going to work for him. So he's thinking of splitting those into a two-day format. Is that detrimental, or what are your thoughts
on
that?
No, there's actually research to back that up. Consistency is the big one with this. I mean, ideally, you ride your rides continuously such that you get the slow fiber fatigue and the glycogen depletion and the certain things actually stimulate the aerobic adaptation that we're looking for. You become better at metabolizing fat. And that's supposedly and probably optimal. But you can do, you know, two-a-days. Do if it's a three-hour ride and you simply can't, your schedule won't accommodate that. You do the first hour or hour and a half in the morning and then make up for the latter half of that in the afternoon. And there's been super good responses to that as well in terms of aerobic adaptation. So breaking up your long rides, especially when they're rides of that sort, you know, endurance rides, low intensity, is totally viable.
Yeah, we've got a great blog post on that on our blog as well about training twice a day that gives you even more information on that. Now, what about the sweet spot based approach, Chad? And this is, what is that? And is that something, or who should consider that?
Okay, so there are a number of reasons that you choose one over the other. And the most common reason is the amount of time you have to devote to training. And there are others that are nearly as important, but that's usually the make or break. You know, if you can spend 3 or 4 hours a day on your bike, go traditional base, build a big wide base, learn to use your fat to its your best capabilities. Most people don't have that time. We don't have that luxury. So we have to make the most out of the limited amount of time and kind of dive right into more muscle endurance oriented stuff or strength endurance oriented stuff. And that's what sweet spot is all about. So you work harder, you work shorter, but you cultivate similar fitness in substantially less time.
Yeah, in general, what we recommend is for the traditional base, that's really, you've been going for a long time. And it was like, we had a question about this a couple podcasts ago, and someone's like, oh, I'm not getting these huge jumps, right? And you've kind of plateaued. Like if you were, you know, a Cat 1 racer, or you're going to do, we do this for Ironman people too, go with the traditional base where you're planning your whole season, and you really have to build your body to a whole new level of, and make that like, it's like a small increase for the majority of people. Sweet spot base is where it's at. you'll get a higher FTP, sooner. It's not enough volume to burn you out. You're probably going to get have a better season on sweet spot base. If you're anything but the very experienced athlete, or someone like an Ironman racer who's at the same time doing lots of other training stress. Chad, is that a good way to put it?
That's exactly right. The more experienced you are, the more closely you've pushed yourself to your potential, the more necessary it becomes to broaden your base with this long, slow stuff that again shifts the energy demand more towards fat. So you've exploited almost your muscular capacity in terms of, you know, muscular endurance, and you have to kind of raise the level of fat metabolism so that you preserve your sugar stores for longer. And then when it comes time to work hard, you haven't necessarily touched them yet. But this is fitness that is cultivated slowly. It takes a long time. And that suits long timers, people who are very experienced and have pushed up toward that potential. It suits ultra endurance athletes who are going to be out there working at levels where they need high levels of fat oxidation. They need to be able to use the fuel that's very plentiful. And then sweet spot, it's simply more demanding, and the fitness isn't as high or as long lasting. But for most people, time constraints aside, it's more satisfying. It's more motivating because the gains come more quickly.
And the workouts are more interesting. Traditional base, when you start, you know,
absolutely,
there's only so many ways we can make right at 65% of your FTP interesting. Sweet spot though is, for the majority of people, it's sweet spot seriously is where it's at. If you're doing big stage races later on or Ironman's, go traditional base. But other than that, you know, you're doing some crits and stuff, and your Cat 3, Cat 4, sweet spot base, I think is where it's at.
Yeah. Even in years past when I've raced Cat 2 and high level Masters 1, 2, 3 races, I've done it on largely a sweet spot approach. Didn't build a big winter base. Still went into these races that sometimes went as long as 4 or 4.5 hours and did just fine.
Great advice. Richie, I usually do my workouts in the early evening after work, starting between 6 and 7:30. And one of my biggest demotivators leading up to the workout, apart from being tired after a work day, is being hungry and sitting with my family while they eat. That would be torture. is there a way for me to calculate my nutrition requirements for a workout based on TSS, intensity factor, etc., and then consume it in the afternoon and early evening in a way that I am not coming into the workout craving food? Let's answer that question first. Yes, he has another question after that. But yeah, Chad, so Richie, how would he do that?
Richie, I don't think you need to get quite that detailed. You don't need to know exactly how much food you're going to use or exactly how many calories you're going to expend and then match your intake accordingly. You have plenty of stored glycogen. Even if you feel tired, it's still there. Plenty of fat. Everyone does. I don't think you need to be so scientific about it. Rather, you need to time it accordingly. So you're just trying to manage your appetite. It doesn't sound like it's having any effect on the workout itself. So it's really just appetite management, which, you know, if you can do it 4 or 5 hours out, includes some protein and fat, stuff that burns slowly and will satiate you longer. And then you get closer to the ride, that intake has to be more accessible, has to burn more quickly. So carbohydrates and then increasingly refined, sugar ready, if you will, carbohydrates. And you don't even have to do it prior. You can do it on the ride too, but it sounds like you're trying to get through that period before the ride. So depending on how far you are out from the workout, that will kind of determine what you eat such that it digests in time, that it's not holding you back when it comes time to work hard.
A couple things on this. One, that's actually a feature, we've wanted to implement for a while, and we should, is that based on your FTP, we can calculate the amount of calories that you would, if you did the workout perfectly, how many calories you'd burn. But as Chad said, you don't need to calculate it that close. The other thing about this question is, I think some people think like, I cannot eat right before my workout, and I don't know, I would eat with my family and just see how it feels a little bit. Sure. Like, don't think that, and anyone listen to this podcast, like, oh, I must eat 3 to 4 hours before each time. People are different. I knew I was going to do, I'm primarily a triathlete with a little bit of road racing, and I knew I was going to do triathlons, and I knew you had to eat during triathlons. So I would eat like dinner, then I would go run 5 miles just because I wanted to train myself not to kind of have a upset stomach. The other thing that's kind of interesting with, you know, how your body absorbs that food, I think, Chad, I saw you purchase this. We talked about it a couple of weeks ago, mm-hmm. but we're big geeks, right? So we want to test our blood as we're working out. And another question relates to this, but in the morning, what I experience is if I do a workout in the morning, I kind of feel not as strong and a little shaky, but I want to experiment with other food and measure my glucose like a diabetes patient would as I go through the workout and see if there's a correlation between that. Chad, we need to do that and report back, because I'd like to see if eating 4 hours before makes you feel better, or an hour before, or what kind of food.
This is going to be a big part of my life for the upcoming months and a good portion of the race season. I have a training camp coming up. I don't want to experiment with anything risky right now, but as soon as I get past that, I'm going to start monitoring both my blood glucose as well as my ketone body. So the difference between a sugar adapted athlete and a fat adapted athlete, which is pretty extreme. They're very different. Same outcome basically, but certain limitations with each. And as I go through that process, you can bet I'm going to share as much of it as you guys are willing to listen to.
And I assume, Richie, that you're in the situation that you're commuting home because you're mentioning a work day, then eating at home with your family. And for me, when I train in the evening, I'm not typically the type of person that's like the eat every 20 minutes type of person or anything like that. I have established meals. But I eat something on the way home as I'm going home, and I make sure that I have a little food in my stomach before I work out. And I generally do that because that's how I race. And that's kind of what, I think this insight that we're going to be able to get from measuring these different data points that Chad and Nate mentioned, hopefully that gives us some data to back up just perception on this. Don't worry about that. And also keep in mind the fact that you might actually have to be racing on food. So you have to find out how to make that work. You should ask the fat cyclist how he does it. He eats cold pizza somehow. I don't know how he does that.
Dude,
so
I drink coffee.
He races on cold pizza.
I'll drink coffee in my during my intervals, like between intervals.
So will I, yeah.
You guys are crazy. So
cream, heavy cream.
Mike, you say you're an older cyclist at 74 and you're just getting back into cycling. It's going very well. You're losing weight and you're getting better at climbing. Your average speed on a road ride is right around 14. You use Trainer Road and wonder what program would help you. And you say you're using a Wahoo Kicker. Well, good to have you on with Trainer Road, Mike, and good to hear you're getting back on the bike and getting in some good riding shape there. This is a pretty general question, Mike, but to be honest, we just talked about base training. Chad, do you want to touch on maybe bass training would be a good fit? I don't know. What would be a good fit for Mike?
Yeah, I think that's a logical place to start. So Mike, you're looking for, and we use, you know, scientific terms, but more basic terms, you're looking for low-end fitness or low-end endurance and high-end endurance. You know, the low-end is more aerobic and the higher-end endurance is more muscular. The difference between the two isn't really relevant right now. Just so much as to say that you have to, especially at your age, it's better to build up gradually. I wouldn't recommend having you dive into VO2 max intervals until you've built sufficient aerobic base and probably a bit of muscle endurance. So, you know, a traditional base approach where you work at low intensities up to maybe 80% eventually of your threshold is probably a safer place to go. If you have an endurance background and you know you can get away with a higher workload, you could work towards the sweet spot base approach where you work up to, you know, 90 and eventually a little higher than that, those percentages of FTP.
And Mike, you also talk about, you mentioned your average speed, and you've just mentioned to us that you'd like to increase your average speed. And to be honest, we've given some good tips on that, and it's really a gradual thing that will happen over time. It'd be great if there was something that we could do that would just change it quickly, but it's a combination of strength endurance, like Chad said, being able to sustain that force that you're putting into the pedals for an extended period of time. Building that base fitness will substantially help with your aerobic fitness as well, and that will come into play. And in addition to that, like Nate brought up earlier, refining your position and aerodynamics on the bike will be extremely helpful as well. So I figure those are the best ways to do it. And really, I've always found that the best way to increase my average speed, and don't take this too literally here, is to ride with other people. And I'm not saying I just draft off of them and increase my average speed, but when you are riding with another group or with a group, and maybe they're a little quicker, assuming that you are going out for group rides or anything else like that, if you are doing that, that can be a good situation, or put you in a situation where you're kind of raising, or I should say overstepping certain bounds that you might keep yourself to otherwise. But to be honest, the trainer does that for you at all times. So it's fantastic for that. Robert, I'm looking at utilizing the traditional base high volume plan. After reviewing the plan, so that's, we've already talked at length about traditional base. That's one of our training plans that we have for base training.
And he's actually comparing it to sustain power build back up just a bit.
Ah, there we are. Perfect. After reviewing the plans, I noted a marked drop in TSS per week from the base plan to the sustained build plan, which would equate to a drop in you're talking about your training load and your overall fitness. I know I can modify the sustained build by adding volume or intensity in order to increase TSS, and that's training stress, and thus maintain or continue to build that training load that you're sustaining. But I'd like to understand the purpose of the reduction in training stress during the build phase. Wouldn't that equate to lost fitness? What do you say, Chad?
That's an awesome question, Robert, and I get this a lot, so I'm glad I get to address it in a more public forum so that hopefully a lot of people can hear my response. First off, you bring up a good point where you're asking, or where you say that you know you can increase your stress with longer rides, which is about the safest way to do it, especially if you're already doing a couple days of intervals a week. Most of your increased stress, as you put it, your chronic training load is going to come with greater mileage, greater volume. But TSS is an extremely useful metric, and it's especially useful within a training phase. But from training phase to training phase, it can be a little misleading. So when you're riding, you're doing a base phase, for instance, and you can jack that TSS or your stress up really systematically, it's useful. You can see last week I did this, next week I need to do this, and then the following week this, such that I'm increasing the stress on my body, ideally increasing the adaptation that takes place. But the sort of stress you're incurring is very different from what happens when you move into the build phase. And then it's even more different for what happens when you move into the specialty phase. So if you're using solely TSS to monitor your progress, you're going to see little dips. But once you get, or you will most likely see little dips. But once you get into that next phase, that's when it becomes really useful again. You have a basis, and then you move based on that. You increment things depending on how much stress you can handle on a weekly basis, how much stress increase. But phase to phase, it's hard to compare them because the stress from one phase is very different from that of another. You know, riding at 60% for 4 hours and the stress it accumulates can be done in an hour of VO2 max repeats. But what it does to your muscles and the rest of your body is substantially different.
Kieran, you mentioned that you're new to Trainer Road, so we're glad to have you on board and training with Power, and you've got a question. I'm currently following the Sweet Spot Base training plan that we have. Good to have you following that as well. My power tap is currently set up on the trainer, and I've been swapping out one of the longer weekend trainer rides for a club ride of 3 to 6 hours. I want to know, should I continue to use my power meter on the club rides, which are generally fairly steady? And we actually, we answered a similar question to this last week. But Nate, do you want to take this one here?
Yeah, in general, I'll do the abbreviated answer. We said last week is yes, keep your power meter all the time and collect all the data you can. In the future, hopefully we'll have some products that can analyze it. But as Chad said last week, the more data, the better. Looking back at it later, you'll probably want to see some stuff. You can upload those rides, something like Training Peaks, or they have TSS, or Strava has their Suffer Score, and you can kind of get a better picture of what kind of stress you're having the weekends. Because you're doing Sweet Space 1 mid-volume, and you're doing a six-hour ride, you could be blowing away all the TSS, like you could be equaling the entire TSS of the week in just one ride. And then if you start getting tired, you can look back at that data and say, maybe I should reduce my club rides a little bit, or probably the length of it, to make sure that I'm not blowing my TSS completely out of the water.
Great advice. Good stuff. Doug says, hi, Chad and Jonathan. Love the advice on the podcast. Thanks, Doug. Glad you're enjoying it. And you mentioned the fact that you seem to lose power and motivation going up steep climbs at the end of your riding season. This year, it seemed to coincide with September. What can I do differently this winter to avoid this? And you're asking, is it normal to have this kind of this drop off in that type of fitness? What do you say, Chad?
So Doug provided a lot of other information too. So we know that his fitness was high, you know, in July and August, but by September he started to fade. So chances are he just pushed it a little too far. I mean, like I said earlier, that whole wave analogy, you can ride it as long as it carries you, but at some point it's going to start to taper or fade off. And I think that's all you're coming up against, Doug. So, you know, what happens then is up to you. You maybe take a week or two off. You maybe revert to some aerobic base training. It depends on what the rest of your season looks like, when your important events fall, that sort of thing. But it's perfectly common. It happens to everybody. So, you know, plan for it or learn how to mitigate it.
Ben, I'm training for a gravel race in April that's about 40 miles with 40,000 feet or 4,000 feet.
Whoa.
Of climbing. 40,000, my goodness, that would be insane. 4,000 feet of climbing. But it's potentially harder than it sounds because the weather in Vermont is very variable at that time of year, and gravel roads can be pretty muddy and even covered in snow. I'm shooting to finish in 3.5 hours. It's a good goal. And if you want another gravel race, we have an awesome one out by our office called the Grinduro that's pretty sweet that you should sign up for next year. My training is all low volume and the training is going great, but I'm guessing with a low volume plans that my body is going to be really tuned to putting out sustained power for an hour and a half. What's going to happen in the last 2 hours of the race? It's tough for me. And Chad, let's handle that one first. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a valid concern, Ben. We're not necessarily in all cases cultivating particular power related to particular time periods. We're trying to train the body to simply be capable of more work. So as you get stronger and you cultivate greater endurance, whether it's strength endurance, aerobic endurance, whatever, your fitness level lifts in general. And then when it comes time to do a ride like this, you know, 80% 1 year is 200 watts, but your fitness improves the next year and 80% becomes 220 watts. So it's not like you're going to hit that 90-minute mark and just fall apart. To that point, you're not working at what you could do maximally for 90 minutes. You know, you've dialed it back a bit so that you can last longer. So when your fitness in general rises, lower percentages of your fitness rise with it. So just be sensible and pace accordingly, which is really what it comes down to: higher fitness and proper pacing.
What about
and a good strategy for some? Oh yeah, go ahead, Nate.
What about Chad too? As he gets closer to the race in April, mm-hmm. to maybe skip some of those workouts, and it sounds like he might want to go outside and practice on the gravel. Maybe do some 3-hour rides.
Yeah, that's the second part of his question. It's excellent too. He's fortunate in the sense that as he gets closer to his event, he has more time available and can do exactly that. And that's the essence of periodization. As you get closer to your events, you want your training to become more specific and to more specifically or more closely emulate its demands. And some of those demands aren't something we can recreate on a trainer. We can't tell you how to control your bike in gravel and mud and wind and cold temperatures. Although we could probably do cold temperatures, but so get outdoors, you know, do your quality training inside, do your more race specific stuff inside to a point, but then get outside and experience both the duration of that event. Get out and do a 3.5, a 4 hour ride, do it in the gravel, do it in any conditions that are under your control that you can match to the day of your event.
I've had great success, Ben, with long events, ranging even longer than 4 hours long. I've had fantastic success in following a training plan, much like what you're doing, of having workouts that are 60 to 90 minutes that are very structured. And then on the weekends, I get out and I put in one big long ride. And when I say big long ride, it's generally a 5 to 7 hour ride. If I do that, I'm all set. Like Chad already mentioned, it serves, and I guess I should say it's extremely effective the closer you get to your event to have something like that. So and good on you for recognizing that.
And once you've built a good aerobic base in one manner or another, the maintenance, you know, but doing a single weekly long ride, even maybe every 2 weeks doing a long ride, is actually more sustaining than most riders realize.
This is a parallel to this is with like Ironman athletes or half Ironman athletes, where you're probably not going to do a 6 hour ride, but getting out on your TT bike, you know, on some of those weekends closer to your race. So instead of doing it a year out, as you get closer, kind of do those 80 mile, 90 mile rides in your TT bike, in your TT position, that kind of, you know, ices the cake at the end for what kind of specific event that you're going for in for triathlon or Ironman racing.
Yeah, and while it's ideal, even if you know you have a 112-mile bike leg coming up and your longest ride has been 90 miles, doesn't mean you're going to fall apart at 90 miles.
Yeah.
You've got the endurance to last 90 miles. You've got the endurance to last 112. It's, again, just a matter of pacing. And in that case, it's a very subtle difference between 90 and 112.
100%. And that's too, why marathoners, like, they don't run 26 miles in training because it really beats your body up, right? A lot of people run 20 or 18, and I've heard some people not running any more than 2.5 because it just takes too long to recover from, and it messes up their other training and it leads to injury. We don't have the injury side as much as running does, but don't think like, oh, I haven't gone that far, so I can just never go that far again. As Chad said, it's your fitness is there. It's just the pacing and percentage of FTP that you're racing at.
Yeah, great point. And along those lines, remember the training you've done on race day when you get into that unfamiliar territory with the duration of your race. Remember the training you've done and take confidence in the training rather than, you know, trusting more the doubts that you may have. Trust yourself more than doubts. That's a good thing to stick to. So John asks, if I have a stages power meter, should I use it to control my kicker? That sounds like a question for you, Nate.
Yeah, so this question, we get something like this a lot. So for those who don't know what a kicker is, a Wahoo kicker, it's an electronic trainer and it has a power meter built in, and the power meter is in the flywheel on the trainer. And the stages power meter has the sensor on the crank arm, and it measures the flexion on the actual crank arm. And what can happen almost with everyone, there'll be a wattage difference between their power meter, so they have any power meter, and their kicker or their CompuTrain or whatever electronic trainer. And so let's say there's a 10 watt difference or a 20 watt difference. What they want to do is have that same like source of power. So they, if you have a stages power meter, I recommend outdoors using the stages power meter, and then indoors on the kicker, also pairing your stages power meter so you're consistent between the two. Also, if you had different power meters and they're reading off, I would say just, you know, try to calibrate them and get them close. But if you can't, I would just stick with one power meter and switch it around bikes. So what we do is we have a product called Power Match, and that does two things. One is we'll read the offset between your kicker and your stages power meter. So if your stages rate is reading 20 watts too high the whole time, we'll adjust the resistance on your trainer. It's electronic trainer, so it'll we can lock in the resistance. We'll adjust it so that your target power actually your what you're putting out and your target power match. That works really well as long as you keep your cadence consistent. If you have a very fluctuating cadence and you're all over the place, it's hard to lock those in. So for those people, we have another option that's just a constant offset. So you can just say, hey, always adjust my kicker by 20 watts because I know the stage's power meter and the kicker have 20 watt difference. And then, you know, everything should be fine. Another thing to think about is if you have a cork, you can do, or another power meter where you can do an actual calibration. So not just the offsets, like what you do with a power meter and you offset it, that's like zeroing a scale. So if you offset a power meter, that's just, you know, you push the tar on your scale and everything's even. If you calibrate your power meter, that's actually affecting the slope. So the slope is as it gets harder, what's the rate of increase? So as these, what are they called? Strain gauges move, what's the rate of increase on the weight? And to be able to actually calibrate a power meter, you have to hang a weight from your cranks. It has to be a known weight. So the one that we use here at Trainer Road, it's a 25 kilogram weight and it's certified to 2 grams. So you can't just do it with some weight like that you got at the gym or home gym. Those could be off by 100 grams and that'll throw it off. So what I've found is with my kicker, I'll do a spin down with the kicker and that will measure the, I'm sorry, I'm getting so technical, everyone, but that will measure the resistance in this, the friction in the spin down, and that will make the kicker more accurate. And then with my cork, I hung a weight and, you know, I zeroed it. I didn't zero it, but I figured out the slope based on cork software that you can get on your iPhone. And then I zeroed my cork after that. And my slope was different than my manufacturer slope. Maybe because we're at a different elevation, the pressure's different. I don't know. But in the end, they both matched. So that's the long answer is yes, just use Power Match. Or that's the short answer. I'll talk about this stuff also, all day.
When we're talking about that, the approach going through with setting or manually setting the slope, it's a process where precision, Nate mentioned the precision and the weight, precision and how it's executed is also something that's really important. I know SRAM recommends that you don't do that, but if you're getting crazy readings, you can talk to their support, and I know their support will walk you through it too. So that can help. Ben, I have a technical question for you, but it does relate to Trainer Road. Good to hear. So last week, somebody commented that their kicker reads 20 watts higher than their Garmin Vector pedals, just like what we were talking about. And you guys laughed like that's a known thing. I upgraded to a kicker from a Kurt Kinetic Road machine this year, and I was surprised that my FTP actually went up from my last FTP test the previous year, even after taking 6 weeks off riding. Can you comment on whether the kicker tends to read high? Nate, I'll let you take this one again.
Yeah, it's tough. I would always do the spin down. I can't say if it reads high or low all the time. I would say just be consistent, and as long as you're consistent, you'll have a good experience with it.
And also remember, this is one point that I wanted to make with this previous one, but it fits better here. So remember that this is a measurement of your power. It's taking force and speed, and it's representing your output in terms of wattage, right? So the hard thing about that is a lot of people, they'll use a power meter, and you know what we all do, and you guys know this too. We like the power meters that give us bigger numbers. So that pads our ego a little more. It's something that's really, I think, misunderstood, that we assume that one power meter is wrong and one is correct. The fact is they're all measuring power in different ways. So it can get a little tricky, like Nate said. The important thing is consistency day to day with the same power meter, making sure that you are doing the same process, whether that's on your kicker, whether that's going through and doing a spin down every time, which I recommend doing. Just making sure that things are consistent day to day. That's the best thing to do. As far as us commenting on whether the kicker tends to read high, you know, in my case, it reads high, but I know in other cases, I've seen plenty of other cases that it reads low. So, you know, I don't think that it reads high or low technically. It's just different.
I know
that sounds like a cop out, but
I know with the Garmin. So in general, if power meters were all 100% accurate, in general, you would get a higher power reading the closer you are to your feet. So like something on the shoe should be higher than something on the pedal and on the cranks and the bottom bracket to the power tap or the trainer, because there's drivetrain loss that you'll have as, you know, as the power measurement goes farther away. But in this case, the Vector is actually lower. And I know with the Garmin Vector too, there was problems earlier. What if you didn't calibrate it right and you didn't tighten it down to the exact right tension, you could have bogus power numbers. So I'm assuming you're doing that, but for other people, if you have Garmin Vector, make sure you actually use a either have a bike. Well, I wouldn't say a bike shop really. Use a torque wrench when you do it so that you really get it down to spec.
Yes, that is extremely important. And Ben also mentions the fact that, so his FTP test went up because he went from training with, it looks like a Rove machine, so I'm not sure if he had a power meter, but to a kicker. And you were surprised because you felt like it read higher than what you had before. And you're now saying that the base training, you're 5 weeks into sweet spot base, and you say it's pretty easy. It's not particularly challenging. So you ask, is base training meant to be relatively easy? Is it just prep work for the build phase? Should I push my FTP up a little? So it's very possible that your FTP, or it's very possible that it may be a little low, but yes, base training is probably not going to be as hard as what you did prior. You mentioned that before you just found a few rides that you liked and you did them a lot. And many times we pick those hammer fest rides that are tough. So it's tough to separate perception from reality in this case. But having said that, if you take an FTP test and you feel like you've gone as hard as you can and you have a power meter measuring it, stick with that number that you're using there. So, you could have underassessed. It could be just the fact that the base training is easier than what you're used to. Any comments on that, Chad or Nate?
Just that it's easy to undershoot your actual potential. A lot of people, especially if you're new to FTP assessment, don't know how to pace properly for, you know, 8 or 20 minute time trial. We've addressed this before. So you'll get better each time you assess. If over the course of the workouts, you feel like you're not getting much out of it and you understand what it should feel like. I mean, if there's workout instructions on the screen that are telling you just hang in there for one more minute, safe to say that it's a demanding interval. We're trying to coax you through that final minute. If you're not feeling that, something's amiss. So you might consider nudging your threshold up a little bit such that the demands, the expected demands of the workout are a little more in line with what you're going through.
Yeah, the great thing, and this is how I actually found Chad, I was doing some of his cycling workouts, is that at the end of Chad's workouts, especially sweet spot base, you should feel taxed and like, that was a good workout, but I could have done a little bit more. If you feel like you weren't taxed at all in sweet spot base, totally raise your FTP. You probably under-tested and under-assessed, and you need to raise it. Is that a good way to put it, Chad?
It is, yeah. And how much you raise it is certainly subjective, but it usually falls somewhere in the 3 to 5% range. So, veer low, calculate what 3% of your threshold is, add that on, see how the workout goes. If you're still not quite feeling it, add another couple percent on. But usually by the time you hit a 5% increase, you're much more in the ballpark, if not right on.
Frederick is going through traditional base, our traditional base training plan, the high volume version. So it has him on the bike for 2.5 hour sessions, roughly around there 4 times a week. And his question, it's for triathletes, really. He's asking Chad, how would I combine that with two running sessions? And it sounds like you're doing 10K sessions, I think. I'm not really sure.
I think he's training for a 10K.
Okay, gotcha. So how would he combine that with two running sessions, one outdoor ride, his four long workouts that he's doing on the trainer, how would he combine that with two running sessions and an outdoor ride, Chad?
So I'm actually in the midst of devising triathlon plans right now, base and build plans. We've already got the specialty plans in place, so kind of backtracking a bit and making more specific base and builds for triathletes, considering that they have to work around two other disciplines, and even for duathletes with another, which you may very well be, Frederick. You're only mentioning the run here. So it looks like you're working out, well, you're on the bike 5 days a week, 4 times indoors, 1 times outdoor, outdoors, which leaves you at least one day where you can just run, and that would be my advice. The second one, you have to decide where you're gonna put that. Ideally, pick your easiest ride and do your second workout, your run workout on that day. Where you put the run, either prior to the ride or post ride, depends on which is your greater strength, which you need to be fresher for. If you're a great runner, prioritize the bike. If you're already a good rider, runs weak, prioritize the run. But you're just going to have to make the two match. I will lend some structure to that. Whether or not you choose to follow those plans is entirely up to you, of course. But I'm going to try to help people, multi-sport athletes in particular, shape their weeks such that their additional disciplines, the swim and the run, are also accounted for.
All right, Mark asks, we'll lay out the scenario. He did the 8-minute FTP test, and you mentioned that you lost 17 watts from your last test. but you noticed that your lactate threshold heart rate went to 155. You adjusted all your zones to reflect the new zones. When riding outside the next day, I noticed my heart rate was just in my lactate zone, but my power was in tempo. I was doing a zone 2-3 workout, so power was fine, but heart rate was a little high. And I felt you didn't feel like you were breathing too hard and you could have gone harder. So your question is, why is my heart rate high? And should power zones and heart rate zones match up for the most part with understanding of heart rate being not as stable as power? What do you say, Chad?
Yeah, so there you go. Heart rate's not as stable as power. But you can, particular to you and you alone, devise corollaries. You can see, you know, when I'm working at sweet spot, my heart rate falls within this narrow range. When I do VO2 max intervals, it falls within this range. That's going to have to be specific to you, and it's going to change from time to time based on some of those variables that affect heart rate and won't affect power. So it's tough. Don't let it mislead you, though. Power is still king. Heart rate's still very informative, but try to pay more closer attention to the power than heart rate.
Carlos, I usually get cramps during long races, but never while training. I've tried salt tablets and always drink a lot of sports drinks. I even tried to hold back my pace a bit, but I get cramps anyways. What do you recommend in order to avoid cramps? Is pickle juice an option? I've heard of that.
Yeah.
and actually, I ride with a guy that, and I have no clue if this works. He's exceptionally weird at times, and he takes mustard packets with him. Chad, what do you say to all this stuff?
Yeah, I think both the pickle juice and the mustard packets are a really good example of how just wide-ranging people's approaches to controlling cramps has become. And it's really hard to find anything definitive or truly helpful that across the board squashes cramps. In my personal experience, it's a matter of the stress your muscles are familiar with and exceeding that level. And it happens a lot in race situations. You know, you train in a particular way, and then the race puts you outside of those familiarities or those bounds. And next thing you know, you're cramping. Or even on a long ride, whether with other riders or whatever, you get pushed into something that's a little outside of your current capabilities, and your muscles cramp. I had a race years back, the Cascade Classic. Actually won the time trial, held the yellow jersey through the criterium, had a road race the next day, was so intent on staying well-positioned that I pedaled the entire 3.5-hour ride. And when it came down to that final climb, where the guys that mattered were all within a particular cluster, they moved. I couldn't go with them because I had spent so much time pedaling. My muscles were so overburdened that they just locked up. And for 15, 20 seconds, I was basically useless. I had done in a race something I wasn't accustomed to. I had just pushed the muscles to a point that they were firing so consistently and so frequently and without any real rest that I overwhelmed them. So it's a matter of adapting your muscles to the stress you plan to face on race day. Again, that whole specificity.
Yeah. So to continue on that, there's no definitive research that salt, like lack of salt or lack of electrolytes causes cramps.
Sodium in particular. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, I know that was kind of like maybe an 80s and 90s things, but if you Google it around, no one really knows what causes cramps. And I'm in the same camp that Chad is. It's because you're pushing yourself and doing things you haven't done before and your muscles can't take it. That's all I have to say about it.
And also,
forget hate mail.
Maybe, you know what? I'm going to bring the hate mail on to a certain extent. So I agree with you in the sense that you're doing you may be doing something you don't do all the time, but there are a lot of people that race a lot and they still get cramps. And it's mm-hmm. the same type of racing that they do all the time. So here's what I can say. The only thing that has actually consistently helped in multiple occasions for me is in multiple phases during my training. I've noticed I'm getting cramps again. This is strange because I usually don't deal with them. I've found that focusing on flexibility in conjunction with making sure I'm preparing myself for the demands of the race really seems to make a difference. But once again, I have zero research behind this. And I think the cramp thing is quite a mystery that we're still trying to solve. I guess that's enough said on cramps there. Lauris, you had one. We're just going to cover just a couple more questions here. But Lauris, you asked, is Power Match in our new PC beta? We're having a public beta for our new PC app right now. It's not yet, but probably by next week is what Nate says on that. So
no problem. It's scheduled. We'll see if it gets done, but probably next week.
Sweet. Paul, You just finished listening to one of our podcast episodes and you liked it. It's good to hear. My questions are with a traditional bass high volume. You're asking if you could lift weights, or you're saying, I could lift weights on the Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and I was going to repeat one of your bass plans in December, January, and February. This is so I can teach skiing on Monday and Wednesday evening at my local ski area. Last year, I did your traditional bass or high volume plans starting in December, and you sacrificed your ski season, missing the best snow year in a long time. That's unfortunate. Dang. Can I race during base three and your build plan? So that's the main question. Can I race during the latter portions of base and into a build plan, Chad?
Yeah, there's no, and you can race anytime, of course, but if you want to do reasonably well, by the time you get through base three, you're working at really high percentages of threshold. There's a fair amount of work in there that pushes you right up to threshold, very close to it. And there might even, now I don't think there's any over-unders, but you're right up there, 95, maybe up as high as 95% of threshold. So you're right there. So you've got a decent base of aerobic base as well as strength endurance. You want to start weaving in some low priority races? Absolutely. Same goes for the build plan. In fact, the build plan, I kind of anticipate that people are going to be doing some C and B priority events. Not the big important ones, but still races they'd like to do well in, but it's not imperative. But starting to weave that racing stress into your curriculum, that's excellent timing. At the end of base three, start doing your C priorities. Sometime during the build plan, start weaving in the B priorities. Then when you hit your specialization, the A priorities start to crop up.
Chris, I'm a 40-year-old dude who has been riding for 2 to 3 years. This year, I put in a ton of riding, starting racing crits and cyclocross, lost a bunch of weight, and you're hooked. I want to get faster, eventually win a grand tour while breaking the hour record on one of the rest days. Those are good goals. Good goals, Chris. Yeah, ambitious for sure. Is there anything a rider my age should do differently with an off-season training plan, or should I just follow the base build specialty plans like anyone else? What do you say, Chad?
I don't see why you wouldn't just follow those plans. You are at 40 years of age, considered a master's rider. I mean, we're aging. There are certain concerns, and not just with your preseason training, but with training in general. Your recovery might be a little slower. Certain things start to decline. Weight training becomes a little more important, and not necessarily to benefit your cycling so much as to keep you healthier and maintain your bone density and mitigate your strength loss and things like that. But as far as the format, base build and specialty still applies.
And the last question for today is from Kevin. Can you please provide additional information regarding the Kinetic InRide 2, the new one that just came out? Is it supported by any trainer road versions other than the new Windows or the new PC beta? Is it supported in the iOS app? Nate, can you answer that one?
Yeah, so for those who don't know, Kirk Kinetic came out with a new version of their InRide. It's the outside shell is exactly the same, but there's new improved firmware. If you have an older version of the InRide, Kirk Kinetic will upgrade it free. You just have to contact them on their support page, Google it. It's Kirk Kinetic support. Just Google that. Right now, it's only in the Windows beta. We're having a shared, I'm getting technical again, but basically the device layer will move over to iOS as soon as Windows gets out of beta. So hopefully that's going to be in 1 month, and then the iOS app will have it next. And then after that, it'll be Mac, and then we have an Android app that we're working on that should be out with that same InRide 2.0 support.
Awesome. Thanks, everybody, for joining us this week, and thanks for all the questions. If your question didn't get answered and you haven't already, please submit it to support@trainerroad.com. We'll throw it in the queue for next week, and or we'll answer it directly to you via email there. Just as a reminder, you can get this podcast and listen to it after the fact on iTunes. You just search for Trainer Road, Ask a Cycling Coach, whatever you wish there, and you'll find us on there. Leave us a review if you like it. And you can also find us on SoundCloud at trainerroad.com/SoundCloud, or just search for us on SoundCloud as well. Thanks again for joining us, and happy training, guys.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.